I've never used this before, so hopefully it is nice. Yeah. I did do a little test run before just to make sure it actually saved the audio.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Perfect. Awesome. All right. Well, what do you want to talk about first? You want
to do a little intro? Yeah, do an introduction of yourself.
Cool. All right. Well, I'm Jack Jackson, whatever you want to call me. And I graduated from UT, University of Toledo, back in May. And degrees in economics and philosophy. And I'm currently a PhD student at the University of Georgia. And I'm getting my PhD in philosophy. And this was my first semester. So I just finished up first semester, took a few classes. I was a teacher, actually. So I was teaching under a head professor, and I taught the Friday sections on my own. And the class was about 95 students. So that was pretty fun. And other than that, I played college golf at Toledo. And yeah, that's about it.
Cool. How did you end up in philosophy? Was that what you started out as an undergrad, or?
No, I started out as business, and then I changed to econ, and then I picked up a philosophy minor, and then I changed it to a major because I would have taken the classes anyway. So it was just like kind of a, usually how it happens like that. But then what happened is over COVID, when COVID hit, like, you know, everything changes. And as I was sitting at home, I got more and more into just reading. And so just started reading more, and then figured, well, might as well apply for some PhD programs. If I don't get in, then who cares? If I do, cool. And so I actually ended up getting in, and here I am.
Awesome. So it's actually more of a passion thing.
Yeah, no.
How, like, you decided to make that. Yeah.
Exactly. It's funny you say that, because my, like, the guy I'm going to do, if I stay at Georgia, if I stay in academia, because there's just so much going on, like so much uncertainty, but if I do stay and actually like do my dissertation under the guy who I went to Georgia for, he says all the time, he's like, philosophy is completely useless for the real world, which is funny because he's being a little bit of a troll, because it's really not. Like, there are some practical applications, but what he means by that is he's saying that, like, do something, and he said this to us before in class as well, do something that you really, really enjoy, and then try to get good at it and see where it goes. And so that's kind of what my process was.
Yeah, I think there's definitely applications of it. You see a lot of big time CEOs, or like actually transformative companies, they might be physics majors or philosophy majors, things like that. I think similar to, I'm in engineering, and it's kind of like training a way of thinking, teaching you how to think more so than just learning a skill, I guess.
Well, yeah, no, that's like 100% agreed. That's like Peter Thiel. So he was actually, I think he got a BA in undergrad from Stanford, and he's a big time like tech giant. He's also getting into the political sphere, but he did that. He actually published, I think, a paper as an undergrad, which is kind of rare. And then, like, Sam Harris obviously got an undergrad in philosophy, so all kinds of people like that. But yeah, no, you're 100% right. It's interesting you say that, because, like, now that I'm thinking about it a little bit, my the single biggest problem I found in teaching this semester was exactly what you just mentioned, which is that philosophy is not, it's not like any other subject matter. It's radically, radically different. In fact, I just literally, right before this, I just wrote down a definition of philosophy from Norris Clark. And he says that he defines it in his book, The One and the Many, as the critically reflective. So thinking about it, it's reflective or reflexive, meaning the subject matter thinks about itself, and systematic articulate attempt. So it's systematic, like a mathematical type systematic approach, like Euclid's Elements, and articulate, trying to be specific. So the critically reflective and systematically articulate attempt to illuminate our human experience in depth and set it in this grand vision of the whole. And so that's how he defines philosophy, Norris Clark does. And I brought this up to my undergraduates near the end of the semester, because I said, look, a lot of you are very, very concerned about your GPAs. A lot of you are struggling in this class. It was an intro ethics class is what I was teaching. And I said, look, if you compare any philosophy class to, say, a bio class, my favorite whipping boy is biology, and you, because it works so well, because you're going to see why it works so well. If you look at a bio class, what you're doing is, you know, you're reading your PowerPoints, you're reading your textbook, you're memorizing your parts of the plant, you're memorizing, you know, some aspects of chemistry come into play in bio, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in a philosophy class, there's almost no memorization. And the proper analogy between a bio class and a philosophy class would be like going into a bio class and asking why the textbook writers wrote it like this. How did they come to this? How did the researchers come to this information? What were the tests that the researchers did? Are those tests replicable, et cetera, et cetera? So like the famous experiments about the origin of life that appear in bio textbooks, like in the 50s, the ones that have been kind of, you know, slashed to pieces by now. Mm-hmm. A proper analogy between bio and philosophy would be like looking at those experiments and saying, okay, how did they come to those? What were their motivations? What were their assumptions? And then like even generalize from that, what are the assumptions of biology? You know, and keep going on and on from there. And so it's like when I tell this to my undergrads, I think some of them understood that like it's a lot different. You're approaching a subject matter in a radically different way. It's unlike anything you do elsewhere. I mean, you get it a little bit in mathematics and engineering, as I'm sure you found out, but like philosophy in general, you're doing what professionals in other fields do right away. You're right. Looking at the foundations of a certain aspects of stuff. So yeah, that's what I got to say about that.
Yeah. I think that philosophy allows you to have a framework for going into any other discipline that you might choose to do afterwards. You can mm-hmm. apply like a lot of anything you learn in philosophy can be applied then later to other subjects.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you going off of that, I mean, I would say that really, like if you really want to do philosophy for practical purposes, which some people do, a lot of people who are going into law school, like a lot of my students are like, yeah, I'm just taking a philosophy course because apparently it's correlated with higher LSAT scores, which is true. Correlated. There's talk about the correlation, the causation there. But anyway, if you're doing philosophy strictly for practical matters, I think what you said is right, but you'd probably focus more on logic. And you'd think about like arguments, reconstructing them, how to extract arguments from texts. You know, if you're reading a book like just this, I got a book on Plotinus here. And so if you're thinking about this from a practical standpoint, you'd want to go into a paragraph, kind of sift through all the words and like extract the argument, formulate the argument, and then you can attack it, do whatever you want. And that's a great practical skill to have. You got to do that everywhere.
Right. How does economics and philosophy, do they mesh well or?
I mean, well, this is like a whole like, man. So what I did is I was like, at one point I was convinced I was going to get a PhD in econ. Like I was like full set on it. I was obsessed with economics. And then, and you're at UT, so you'd be more familiar with this, but I went into one of the professor's offices over the summer. So this would have been summer 2019. So I was a sophomore going into junior year. And I said, hey, like, you know, I want to get a PhD in econ. I want to be an economist. What do you recommend? And he goes, you're probably too far behind already. And I'm like, what? And he goes, you need to take Calc 1, 2, 3, differential equations, all the statistics courses you can. You need to learn coding. You need to learn Python, R, C++, Java, at least Stata for sure, which is an economics program. And I was like, dude, no, like you're out of your mind. Like, what are you talking about? And so I took a class with him the following spring, and it was a graduate undergraduate split. And I was talking with the graduate students who are applying for jobs. I'm like, oh, so, you know, what are you applying for? And they're like, you know, we're applying for bank jobs. The starting salary is around 50, 60 grand. And I'm like, oh, you know, that's not horrible for an entry level position. What are the requirements? They go, oh, they want you to know all the coding and mathematics. I'm like, so this professor was right.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's like modern economics is essentially mathematics. There's very little theory. There's you just got to know coding. I mean, the best thing to do if you're going to be an econ is have a dual degree in econ and computer science. And so I kind of basically was like, well, I'll finish my major, but I'm not doing this as a career. And it's really interesting because if you look at economics journals now, I mean, it's all like just strictly modeling. I mean, I swear to God, like you can go look this up. They model like family utility functions, which is like they try to put in a mathematical model like a family's utility of going to the beach. I swear this is real. Like I swear, like you can actually go to like high level econ journals and like look up, you know, family utility models, marginal utility models, and they'll take like, you know, me drinking this water bottle and we'll try to like measure the utility of it. And so getting back to your original question, I mean, one, I think this is like absurd. And two, I mean, I really do think there is philosophy of economics. I haven't like read almost anything on that, but they essentially critique like, okay, really what's going on here? Like, is this notion of utility even a coherent one? So somebody like McIntyre, who's an ethicist, would probably say no. Is this approach of like distributive wealth that happens in economics, like, you know, in Marxist systems, et cetera, is that a coherent one? How exactly should econ be conducting itself? What is the domain of economics? Is it supposed to only stick with basically maximizing utility, or is it supposed to go into and kind of bleed into ethics? Milton Friedman's a famous example.
Actually define utility as in this situation? Pleasure. What's it commonly defined as?
In econ, it's defined as pleasure or happiness. So happiness, utility, and pleasure are used synonymously. Okay. But this is a great question, because if we actually think about this, happiness, utility, and pleasure, they're all different. They're all different concepts.
Mm-hmm. And they try to boil this to a dollar amount to do modeling, or do they make pleasure indexes?
There's this made up term. It's called utils, UTILS in economics. And so I have some Oreos here. So like me right here, if I were to eat these Oreos, I would get, you know, one utils or two utils or one util. And it's so we can right off the bat, I'm sure you're like, okay, there's no way this is like real, but no, this is real. Like this is actually real. This is what I was taught at UT, and like it's in economic literature. And so it's very subjective. So it's like, and then you can try to put a dollar amount on that. You can do that. Really, the only thing I can remember, because I haven't done econ in years, is like in environmental economics, where they put a dollar amount on human life, which is done in almost all areas of economics. That's not normal, or that's not abnormal. And they say like a human life is worth $7 million, and then they you know equate that with a certain amount of utility, and that's how we make decisions about the environment and pollution, et cetera, et cetera. But like, I think the most troubling problem, at least to me, is like the conflation of pleasure, utility, and happiness, because happiness is not the same thing as pleasure, and it's not the same thing as utility. Like those are three different concepts that are conflated in economics, and I think that's a very big problem.
Yeah, I would agree. I actually spent some time with environmental economics. I did a research paper on it, and we ended up like just not coming to a clear conclusion on our paper, even just because we maybe had an objective going in, and then we didn't reach kind of the conclusions that I feel like we wanted to draw. And then we were like, what does any of this even mean? You know, I was taking, it was a water analysis, basically. It was called virtual water. So we would say like, it takes this many liters to grow a bushel of corn. And then that corn is exported from Iowa to California, how much water left Iowa and went to California. And basically the whole, some of the thing was we wanted to figure out how to use water the best. What's the best way to use water? And so I think we didn't take into account so many other variables other than how much rainfall is in an area or how much available water is there. It didn't take into account any of the human element to it. So it would have been interesting maybe to include some of the things that you were talking about in that study to see if that would have made it any more coherent. But
well, you know, that's like, that's something I've really been thinking about for the past couple of months, especially in light of this COVID stuff. So this is like, I think this is like really ironic. Back in May, I was taking Dr. Egan. You may have met him, maybe not. And I was taking his cost benefit analysis econ class. This is like my last econ degree requirement. And I ended up doing an extra credit project on just a random cost benefit analysis study. And so I was like, you know, I just picked one that had to do with COVID. I really had no idea. I picked it pretty much at random. And it turned out it was like the famous study from April 2020 that was used in policymakers' decisions to implement social distancing policy. And so I was looking into this and I didn't know it at the time, but as I started reading, I'm like, I've heard these numbers before. And it turns out that it was the famous study. And so anyway, we had to do this, you know, short, like it was like 8 to 10 page, like basically write up of what the study said and kind of like an evaluation. And so I'm reading this study and I'm like looking at the numbers and, you know, I didn't get into all the equations or anything. I just looked at their like basically summarized of after the equations and everything of what they got. And I'm like, and they had their assumptions in there. So the assumptions are really what you want to look at in a study. And I'm looking at, and they said, okay, well, our conclusion is that social distancing is going to provide a benefit to the United States economy. So United States alone is the domain, mm-hmm. not the world, United States economy of around $5.3 trillion. So that's huge. And I'm like, okay, well, this is like a really high number. And so I'm looking, I'm like, okay, well, how do you get to that? And they said, here are assumptions. And they laid out the assumptions and they assumed a $10 million value, statistical value of life for every single human being, no matter the age across the board. I'm like, what the hell is this? Mm-hmm. There's no way. Like, I've never heard, like, because like I said, in environmental economics, the number's around 6 to 7 million. And it scales depending on how old you are. So a baby is going to be around 6 to 7 million, where somebody who's 90 and in hospice is going to be, you know, 10,000. Because that number is based upon like your production and everything. And so these guys in this study, they assume a $10 million statistical value of life across the board. And I'm like, that's like you can't do that. Like that's really bad because that is simply not one. It's not consistent with the rest of economics. Two, that's like actually dishonest because a 2-year-old and a 90-year-old don't have the same risk of COVID and they do not have the same statistical value of life. So why would you assume it? And three, like professional economists should know better. And, you know, I think that I wrote this up. I mean, if anybody wants it, I can just send them the Google Doc. And I was like, this is how they got that $5.3 trillion number. But so the reason I bring this up is because of exactly what you just said. You said in your own study, oh, there were so many other factors at play. Exactly. And that, I think, is one of my biggest problems with economics as a field, is that there are so many variables at play that can't be captured or seemingly can't be captured mm-hmm. in these studies. And this is a problem not with economics, but with psychology, sociology, even the natural sciences. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard of the replication crisis or if you've ever heard of like the famous study from Stanford on why most published research findings are false. But
I mean, I would say in order to talk about anything, especially to write a paper, you have to restrict the domain of a topic by so much that you're not even talking about the topic anymore. You're just like creating your own, I don't know, sort of microcosm that you're going to write your report about.
I mean, that's true. Certainly in all fields, the effects are different because in philosophy, you know, you can write on, let's see what I got here for an example. So like, I don't know, I got a book on Pseudo Dionysius here, and you can write a, I mean, you could spend a career studying one chapter of his work here. And so, yeah, to write a paper, you're really like, I wrote a paper a couple weeks ago on literally like two lines of a Platonic dialogue. But the problem that you brought up, I think this impacts the other fields even more than philosophy, because if you're doing this in the natural sciences or the social sciences, you're right, you're setting your domain so narrow that the question crops up of whether this is even applicable. Like you have this paradox where you go from, okay, well, I'm going to study this X in the real world, and then I'm going to restrict my domain so tiny that this X may be abstracted from the real world entirely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's necessarily what you have to do just because of the limits of language and the limits of space. I mean, you can't sum up all of the interactions of any domain that you want to discuss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, 100%, 100%.
So yeah, I don't know what that leaves you with then. Because sometimes what it seems like to me in the papers I read and things like that is you end up so abstracted, like you just keep moving further and further away from actual reality. And you think if you just like stopped for a second to think about something, your gut feeling would tell you otherwise about some of the findings that you might be getting.
Mm-hmm. 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 I mean, yeah, you could spend a career literally talking about this entire last couple sentences you just said. Like, okay, what is the, for each of the social and natural sciences, are they critically reflective enough? Are they, you know, what are their safeguards in situations like this? Is how, what's the criterion of progress? Yeah, and I mean, these are huge, huge, huge questions.
You also don't write within a vacuum either. So the people that are writing have so many influences on them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Academia in general is a very interesting topic, I guess, if you would to go in and dissect that itself.
Yeah. Oh, man. I mean... We'll see. We'll see what happens with me because I'm young and I'm new. But I mean, just like in philosophy, because that's really where I have more of the expertise is, you know, I mean, it's interesting to compare like what academia is like. So from my experience, to be successful, you obviously have to publish, and to publish, you have to write very narrowly, and you have to be very, very careful about not making big claims. So like I'm working on trying to get some pieces up to standard to submit. And so, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much what anybody would expect. It's a professionalized business, philosophy, mm-hmm. in academia. It's really, you just want to churn out papers and get your name out there, get the CV bigger. But as for like, whether or not that's conducive to actual philosophic enterprise, the philosophic enterprise, I have my doubts. I have my doubts.
Yeah. Do you think that provides value?
Like in my opinion, no. I mean, I don't know. I've had conversations about this with other grad students, faculty, and like other undergrads. And I mean, if you try to like go into most of the stuff out there, most of the journal articles are just not worth reading. They're not, because basically what it is, it's like one or two, maybe three people having a dialogue between each other. And I mean, you're not like for the general public, obviously that's not worth reading at all. For the philosopher, that's probably not worth reading because it's so far afield from your specialty. And even with the person who's whose specialty it is. I mean, it's highly debatable. It's like, to give you a concrete example, I wrote one of my final papers for my Plato class on this very short passage in Plato's dialogue, The Sophist. And there's a ton of work on The Sophist, but there's a couple papers I found mentioning the area I was working on, but like that stuff, it was basically like a dialogue between three people. And so it was like, you know, XYZ from England, literally, like I forgot their names, but they were, all three of these people were talking about this passage that I was working on. Mm-hmm. And they probably spent 200-300 hours plus writing these papers. And it's like, okay, well, yeah, you probed those two lines extremely deep, but at what cost? I don't know.
So how do we, what's a way that you think we could unlock that value? What's a way we could unlock the value of philosophers, if they're publishing? How do we actually get that work out into a more public domain and create more value?
So there's at least two questions here. One is it even value? Is publishing even valuable at all in philosophy? I'd say yeah, for sure. But again, at what cost? And so there are a lot of journal articles that are worth reading. I mean, to one that comes to mind is like Gavin Kerr published a recent article on Thomas Aquinas's Fourth Way, which, you know, I glanced at and it's like, oh, this is like a very new reading of an ancient text. Definitely contributed to the dialogue, like really good stuff here. And then there are articles on like, you know, one word in some super obscure esoteric text, or like, you know, working on something that's so far afield. And so I would say, like, you have to have a prudential judgment about like what work is worth getting out. And like, okay, so how do you go about doing that? My own opinion right now, and this has kind of been my running opinion for about a year, is that people should be producing more commentaries on classical works. Okay, what do I mean by that? So basically, you know, take a text, a classical text, instead of writing super obscure, esoteric academic papers that could or could not be useful, write a commentary on it at a little bit. Obviously, it's going to be technical. Obviously, it's going to be tough. But that's going to be this, that's going to spark this renewal in that text. So for example, let's see what I've got here. So I've got Pseudo-Dionysius here. And so, you know, maybe a philosopher would write a 100-page commentary on Dionysius's mystical theology, which I don't think it's been done before. I certainly haven't found it. And, you know, if that happened, that would be, one, that would get the classic work out, and two, it would get people reading that because they would be able to read it through an expert's lens. So that would be one solution I would think of. And that's kind of my route. Like I've been working a lot more on, like, in my free time, just doing like basically taking a text, like a Platonic text or something, and kind of writing out just my own thoughts on it, like a very, very casual commentary. Who knows? That may develop into something later down the road.
So do you think that, in terms of the classics and stuff, have we lost something that needs to be reclaimed? Like, for instance, the Renaissance was supposedly, a lot of it was due to the reclaiming of old Greco-Roman writings from antiquities and stuff. Is this something like you think could spark some new like paradigms within people that could unlock a lot of value for us?
Oh my God, yes. I mean, just where to begin? I mean, dude, yes, 100%. I mean, to kind of narrow the scope a little bit, look at Lloyd Gerson at Toronto. He has an article on the study of Neoplatonism today. Okay, what is that? Neoplatonism is like thinkers from around the year 200, 100 to 200, all the way up to like 800. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about Plotinus, Proclus, Amblicus, Porphyry, all these guys. And he says in the English world, we've only had Plotinus's Aeneids in translation since the 70s. we've only had Proclus's stuff in translation for the past 30-ish years. And so right there, I mean, we've got Plotinus and Proclus, two of the greatest thinkers of all time, and we've only had them in English for a few decades. So certainly we could mine their work just to unbelievable insights. And then another thing that I learned is that, so philosophy, academic philosophy, is governed a lot by the cultural milieu. And so there are different, when you read a text, this may be really unfamiliar to people who aren't kind of engaged in the subject matter. When you read a text, you can perform different readings of that text. So to give you a very basic example to get your feet wet, when I read the Bible, I can do so many different readings. So like the church fathers, they held you could do a literal reading, or a historical is what they meant. You could do an allegorical reading. You could do a spiritual reading, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you can do like, you know, feminist readings, all kinds of stuff. And basically what you're doing is you're starting from hermeneutical, which means interpretive assumptions, and you're reading a text through those different assumptions. Okay, so in the Platonics, in the studies of the classics, so Plato, Aristotle, et cetera, people start with different assumptions. So personally, I start with, like, I think Gerson, Lloyd Gerson, whom I mentioned before, is correct. So he starts with certain assumptions about Plato and reads Plato through those different assumptions. And so, like, for instance, he will read Plato and Aristotle as being consistent with each other and operating with certain philosophic assumptions that make them really fall into one big category of philosophers who are basically allies with each other. Whereas some people will read Plato and Aristotle as being like mortal enemies. Okay, so with that in mind, nowadays, the cultural milieu in ancient classic scholarship is obviously postmodernism. So postmodern readings are very, very common for Plato, Aristotle, etc. You have a lot of feminist readings that are very common right now. You also have what's called ordinary language, which is kind of dying out, but that's very that's been very common in the past couple of decades, which is basically reading Plato as literally stating what he wrote. And so you're trying really not to go beyond the text. You're just trying to read Plato as what he wrote literally. Okay, so what does all this mean? Well, essentially what it means is that a lot of insights, I think, are being lost. So to give you an example, my Plato teacher this semester, he's an Orthodox Jew, and he teaches like ancient Jewish philosophy, like Kabbalah, which is like Jewish mysticism mm-hmm. and stuff. And he performed in what I think is a like a traditional mystical Jewish reading of Plato. I was just stunned. I mean, it was unbelievable what he did with it, and we can talk about it more if you're interested. But he performed this reading of Plato's Protagoras and Phaedrus, where none of these modern commentators even came close, and it was literally life changing. I was like, this is just unbelievable, and so yeah, back to your question, I really do think, you know, that the study of the classics, first off, can just utterly transform somebody. And second off, the way we're approaching it in our, you know, very, very modernistic, and I'm generalizing here, very, very modernistic sense is probably not very conducive for, you know, figuring out the, unlocking the secret mysteries behind classic texts.
Yeah, I think you kind of answered my question. I was going to say, how well does it translate and how much context do we need? And I think you spoke to that quite a bit. How do we gain the context on what some people might have been addressing several thousand years ago?
Yeah, I mean, a great place to start would be to look at somebody like Alasdair MacIntyre, who talks. So he's a ethicist and historian of philosophy. He wrote the famous work After Virtue. And he talks a lot about tradition, and this is really where I first got exposed to this kind of philosophic idea of tradition, where you want to approach a thinker on his or her own terms within or embedded within their own tradition. So reading Plato you know, you're not going to get much out of Plato if you're reading him and you're a Darwinian, or you're reading him and you're a you know, Beauvoirian feminist. It's like you're taking a hermeneutic and reading it back into the text that's not there. And mm-hmm. while that may be productive for some sort of pragmatic or ideological purpose, you will not understand what that thinker was saying, and you will certainly not gain access to those insights that thinker was attempting to articulate. So my answer would be to have the central concept of your studies be this concept of tradition, where you're going back and you are literally trying to immerse yourself as much as you can in that own thinker's hermeneutical approach, historical approach, cultural approach. And so to give you a concrete example of this, this is going to be something that I'm starting in a couple of weeks, is the Neoplatonists, in order to study Plato and Aristotle, what they did is they had their own set reading list. And so they started with the first Alcibiades, which is a Platonic dialogue. Then they moved to the Gorgias, then the Phaedo, then the Cratylus, then the Theaetetus, and so on and so on. And they had 12 or 13 of these, and they read them in order. They wrote commentaries on them. And in conjunction with that, they were reading Aristotle. So his categories, posterior prior analytics, metaphysics, ethics, etc. And they did this, and that was the way they started philosophy. And only then, after they had read and commentated on all of those works, were they then able to start doing their own work. And so, I mean, I think if you want to understand what somebody like Proclus or Plotinus was thinking about Plato, well, you got to go do something like that. And if you want to understand what Plato himself was thinking, well, you got to go and you got to sit and tarry with his arguments. You got to immerse yourself in Homer and Hesiod and the pre-Socratics. You got to get comfortable with thinking about the questions that they were thinking. You got to get comfortable with the historical circumstances. I mean, it's hard work. And this is where commentaries and scholars can step in. So reading somebody like Lloyd Gerson, or, you know, who's a good commentator on Aristotle? Well, Aquinas is going to be the best. But even somebody like my professor, Edward Halper, he's a great commentator on Aristotle. So reading these people, these commentators, that can help you, because they did the scholarly work of immersing themselves in the tradition, and you can kind of go to them for some help. And I mean, that's another great way, is reading classic commentators if you don't have the time to kind of do all the scholarly immersion. So
it is going to take some time, and it's going to take some effort.
There's
a few directions I kind of want to take this. Aristotle mentored Alexander the Great, correct? Is that true?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Have you looked into the historical context of that at all?
There's not, off the top of my head, I don't think there's that much out there. There's a famous letter that's disputed between the two. I haven't read it. Feel free to go look it up. But I do know that from what I've picked up over the years, basically, I don't think it wasn't like Alexander was a warrior. I think he was doing it more as a hobby. I think that's as much as I can speak
about right now. The philosophy portion, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So what is how foundationally Greek is Western culture? What's the relationship between like Greek thinking, Neoplatonist thinking, and Christianity? And then if you can handle all those at the same time, it seems like we used to have more of a foundation in the classics in this history, like just through normal education. Like you wouldn't have to, I mean, you could study it more, but you would at least have some understanding of these type of classics just through going through, I don't know, like K through 12 or something like that, equivalent to that in the past. So why have we kind of lost our grounding in that type of thinking, I guess?
All right, yeah. So let's take these one by one.
Yeah.
This is
I had to get them out of my head before I lost them, but like let's try to hit those three points.
So first of all, I would say that these questions, I mean, this is like, these are the questions. I'll start with a short little story about the Phaedrus. And I'll say, so in the Phaedrus, which is a Platonic dialogue, we have Phaedrus and we have Socrates, and they're talking for most of the dialogue. And so Socrates gives this just amazing speech about love. It's his second speech, to be specific. And Phaedrus, at the end, he goes, "Oh, Socrates, well, that's a cool speech." And when you read this, you're stunned, because you're like, really, Phaedrus? That's all you have to say? Like, you don't want to say anything else, but that was a cool speech? And the point of this is that Phaedrus, instead of saying, "Oh, wow, Socrates," and starting to ask him questions about love and beauty, he starts talking about the speech. And so, where was I? Oh my gosh, just lost my train of thought. Oh no, here it is. Yes. So these questions, they are questions that are parallel to Socrates' second speech in the Phaedrus, where you can kind of say, "Oh, you know, who cares? Whatever, you know, cool. You know, I'm going to go, you know, watch my, you know, play my video games, watch my football, just kind of have some brews with the boys and not think about these, you know, cool questions." Or you can actually say, "Look, you know, well, what does it actually mean to say that we have kind of lost our grounding in the classics? Okay, what actually is the relationship, if any, between Plato, Aristotle, Jesus, Augustine, etc.? Okay, well, what exactly does it mean to say that the West is Greco-Roman in nature?" And these are the type of questions, just like Socrates was trying to do with Phaedrus and his discussion of beauty and love, that can really lead someone into philosophy. So I would preface this by first saying, okay, this is the type of stuff that really pushes somebody to start a scholarly pursuit and really, really be motivated to reading and understanding. So the first one I'll just give a brief answer to. I mean, I think essentially Socrates, I mean, Thucydides, the historian, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, I mean, they are like the foundation of Western culture. I mean, it's like, I mean, no matter how you want to trace it back, you have to trace all of the West back to Athens and Jerusalem. You really do. I mean, you trace philosophy all the way back to the pre-Socratics, and then Homer and Hesiod, if you really want to go beyond that. And they're precursors to Socrates, but Socrates and Plato took everything from them. And then on the flip side, obviously the Jews, and then Jesus in Jerusalem. I really would stand by this. I don't, anybody who tries to say otherwise and tries to reduce Western culture to anything but Athens and Jerusalem is just being dishonest. There's no way around it. I mean, it's like, you had Jerusalem with the Jewish context, and out of the Jewish context, you had Jesus, which, I mean, we could go on a whole side tangent about how that flipped the Roman Empire upon its head. And then on the flip side, you got the more rationalistic component of Socrates, and really I'm of the opinion, this is a little controversial, but I say the pre-Socratics are really the foundation, because they were the ones who set the scene for Socrates and Plato. So really, I mean, the West is utterly founded upon the pre-Socratics, because they were the decisive break between Homer and Hesiod. You had people like Anaximander, who started asking questions about like the first principle of reality, whereas Homer and Hesiod were more focused on theological mythical interpretations. So I think people like Anaximander, Thales, and Parmenides are the foundation for Western science, Western rationality, and Western theology, like natural theology, like philosophical theology. And on the flip side, obviously, you have Jesus and the Jews, the prophets, who are the foundation for Western spirituality and religion. So that'd be the answer to the first question. Second one, what's the relationship between Platonism and Christianity? Okay, well, the trick here is to define Platonism. So that's really hard to do. I, again, like mentioning Lloyd Gerson again, he defines Platonism as five. He defines it as what he calls a big tent, where a Platonist is anybody who falls within five negative assumptions and seven positive assumptions. And so off the top of my head, the five negatives are: you're a Platonist if and only if, so biconditional here, you're a Platonist if and only if you are an anti-nominalist, an anti-skeptic, an anti-relativist, an anti-mechanist, and something else. But this is in his book, his trilogy on Platonism, for anybody to go look up. Okay. And then he gives seven like positive formulations, and I'll mention one of those. And the main thing is that a Platonist is like directly opposed to, say, a modern Darwinian, where the Platonist is somebody who starts and who reduces reality to a single principle which governs the whole. Where like a Darwinist or somebody like Lawrence Krauss or like a modern day physicalist would reduce reality to its constituent parts, say quarks, leptons, bosons, and say, oh, well, you know, maybe it's nothing all the way down, or it's laws all the way down, as Krauss does in his book about on nothingness. So the Platonist is actually going to say, well, no, there's a foundation of reality, and that's like a necessary, simple foundation. And so that would be the main difference. There's a difference in explanatory power and explanatory scope. How does that impact Christianity? Well, all the church fathers were Platonists. I mean, all the church fathers, Justin Martyr, not all of them, obviously, but most of them, I should clarify. Justin Martyr, Augustine, Gregory, Pseudo-Dionysius. Well, he's not a church father, but he's a saint in the Orthodox Church. All the Gregories, Maximus the Confessor, Thomas Aquinas, Origen. He's disputed on whether or not he's a church father, but he's in the we won't get into him. But all these guys were Platonists, and so they abided by all these assumptions that Gerson lays out in his work. So they believed in all these philosophic positions, and that informed their theology. Okay, so what does all this mean? The crucial aspect here is that the Platonic metaphysics informs their reading of Scripture. And so you can't read the Bible. And I realize I'm saying like massive things here, but feel free, anybody mm-hmm. listening, feel free to you know, either contact me or research this on your own or whatever. But you can't read Scripture without metaphysical assumptions. And so to give you an example, when you are reading Scripture like these church fathers, you are reading them with certain assumptions at play. So you're going to read passages about God's nature portrayed in the Bible. You're going to read those in a certain sense. So somebody who's not a classical theist or who's not a Platonist really may read passages about God having emotions or God having physical parts and actually take those literally. Whereas somebody like Augustine is because of his philosophic commitments, is going to interpret those passages in a radically different way. If anybody wants any more information on this, you can look at the way that William Lane Craig and Ryan Mullins read Scripture and compare that to somebody like Augustine or Aquinas.
Can I jump in here now? Yes, go for it. Do you think that this is primarily because a lot of the Scripture was written to a Greek audience and in Greek context, or is there actually a more like foundational relationship at play here?
So this is like a really, really interesting question, and I'm just starting to kind of like think about this. So if you take John 1, so John chapter 1, first verse. Yes. John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then it goes on to say about the light. Is that related to Greek philosophy? I mean, I think it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, people will probably make the argument. People will argue both ways, but I mean, certainly embedded in the Greek culture that these authors of the New Testament were. I don't know, but my suspicion right off the bat is to say that, yeah, because of the Greek culture, the Greek context, I think there's a relationship there. Also, you have to keep in mind, if Christianity is true, Well, then it would seem that those Greek authors like Socrates and everybody were talking about that one true reality. So like famous passage in, is it in Romans or Corinthians where Paul's talking about the unknown God? It's in one of those, but Paul's preaching to an audience of Greeks. And he's talking about the altar to the unknown God. And he says, look, guys, you got all your altars to your gods, but we have this altar, the unknown God. And this unknown God he's radically, radically different than yours. He's the creator of all your gods. I think that right there encompasses exactly what you're thinking, where the Christian God is the ultimate source of all reality. And so anytime any philosopher, Plotinus, etc., has an insight into ultimate reality, they're necessarily talking about the Christian God. And so then there, by with this argument, there would be a convergence of the two schools of thinking. You really do see Athens and Jerusalem meeting. And that's my approach. That's what I think. Obviously, people are going to disagree with me, etc., but argue it out, you know. So, I mean, we're touching on all these great subjects. I mean, this is perfect. This is how you get people interested, and you get them starting by thinking about these deep questions.
But I'll wait for it to load, and we can at least get the back half here.
Cool.
All right. So where were we?
With the question about the relationship between Christianity and the Neoplatonists, to sum up, basically, there's just a massive connection. I mean, all the church fathers were heavily influenced by the Platonists, Plotinus, everybody, Augustine. I mean, hopefully the audio got some of my previous answer, but I mean, you just got to go and do your own digging into Augustine, into Proclus, into Plotinus to see. I mean, like people like Pseudo Dionysius, all the church fathers like the Gregories, even Aquinas, they're so influenced by Platonism that it's just unbelievable. And I had no idea until I started kind of reading around. But and then that third question of why kind of have we lost our grounding in the classics? I mean, I gave a little bit of an answer with these kind of readings, these ordinary language readings in the classics, the postmodern readings, all the various readings of these texts. With all these readings, you're not getting the author's original insights. If you're not getting the author's original insights, you're probably not getting a lot out of it. So, I mean, that's one answer that I find pretty plausible that I've come to. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are various other reasons people are going to give you other answers, but I would have to say that not operating on the author's own terms, not embedding yourself in the author's tradition, is going to lead you to misinterpreting the author. And if you're misinterpreting the author, then you're not going to be understanding anything that they intended you to understand. And that's going to make it seem boring and not noteworthy.
So much of that, I feel like, has to relate to just the culture that is reading these texts, writing these texts. So has the culture shifted so much that they aren't relevant? Should we try to recapture that culture? What's the interplay there?
Yeah, I mean, to give one answer, this doesn't even have to have anything to do with academia, but you could just say, and I think this is right, that our modern culture with social media has just deprecated on classical education and texts. I mean, people don't have the attention spans to sit down and read a book, let alone study for hours and hours a single paragraph to try to mine the meaning of a Platonic argument. Everything's bullet point. All philosophy. I mean, if you look at just the bullshit on YouTube, a lot of it is just, most of it, 99% of it, from what I've come across, is just god awful garbage. Where it's bullet point philosophy, you're trying to get sum up a thinker's work in 15 minutes. I mean, that's not how academic work is done. That's not how scholarly work's done. It's real academic scholarly work and real philosophic work. It's a lifestyle. I mean, Pierre Hadot has written a lot on this, philosophy as a way of life. For the ancients, and this is not only his work, but if you go back and actually read their text, for the ancient thinkers, I mean, they lived out and they embodied their philosophy. And that's the thing we're missing. I mean, we are missing. That's what we're more interested in the church fathers, to be specific.
Yeah, I would say a lot of our thinking has become sort of devoid of a deeper meaning.
Yeah. We touched on this a little before. It's just memorization and bullet point crap. Where you, I heard one of my buddies. He's like, "Why do you have to study for a philosophy exam? Just go on YouTube and watch some Jordan Peterson." Like, no, that's not what. No, you missed the whole point. No, you study philosophy because it's a lifestyle. It's the church fathers were professional philosophers. They weren't just guys going into a Sunday worship service singing Kumbaya. No, they were living out a worldview, and they were embodied in a philosophic way of life that informed their spirituality. And if you read anything about Proclus or Amblicus or Justin Martyr is a great example. Just go read his Second Apology, and he's just dripping with references to Plato and everything. I mean, and that's what we're missing. That's what we're missing philosophy is an embodied way of life. It's a comprehensive worldview. It's a way to live out your life in modern times. It's supposed to have a practical effect and not just a theoretical one. And you don't get that when you're watching Netflix 6 hours a day.
So how much of the structures have been stripped away? Like, do we need to go build monasteries outside of our large cities in America or something like that? Or how do we actually conduct this at this point in time?
Well, that would be awesome to get back a sense of transcendence and beauty. But I mean, I personally speaking, I just think the universities are, I mean, I don't want to sound too cynical, and I don't want anybody to lump me in with, like, you know, people like James Lindsay who I don't agree with at all. But I really do think the universities are just kind of a bastion of nonsense right now, where I don't know. This is a whole nother conversation, and a lot of it's going to be anecdotal. But I think that I've been severely disappointed in the universities. I think that they are not. And this doesn't have to be a political point. It's like the universities are focused on preparing people for the workforce. They are focused on preparing students to go get a job. They're degree mills. They're not focused on people, you know, developing people as people. They're not focused on embodying somebody and embedding them in a tradition or a way of life. And so I think, you know, if you want to actually do some change, whether it be as an administrator or with your own children or with yourself, you need to start by looking at a place or a setting that allows you to live out a philosophy as a way of life. So a great example would be, the Thomistic Institute that I work with in Washington, D.C. They provide a lot of resources to allow people to do that. But I mean, if you're just going to university, you're not going to get shit from it. You're going to be like, I mean, my students are, it's just watching them is, it's sad. It's really sad at points where they expect to go there, walk out. They haven't developed any they expect not to develop virtues. They expect not to make really good friends. They expect not to learn anything. They just go to college to get a job. Whereas for the medievals, for the ancients, you were training. You were training not only your mind, but you're training your soul and your body as well. I mean, you know, physical fitness was also a component, surprisingly, from Neoplatonism. It's a huge emphasis on physical fitness.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's just necessary to proper functioning of the mind and spirit. Physical fitness is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's, in fact, if I seriously recommend this, if anybody is interested, there's a book called Pure, P-U-R-E, Modernity, Philosophy, and the One by Mark Anderson. He's still alive. He's at Belmont right now. And it's a short, about 100-page book, and it's filled with his reflections And he's a Neoplatonist on modernity. It's like exactly what I'm talking about. I read this over the summer and I've been thinking about it. And especially when I'm reading, you know, classic texts.
Is modernity, great. Is it something that we should fight off and return to a different ethic? Or is it something that we need to just dive full force into? I mean, I'm sure it's somewhere moderately in between, but, you know, is it here to stay? And we need to learn how to navigate this, or maybe even dive deeper into it, or is it return something that's going to help?
I think, interestingly, modernity is really, I don't even think you can define it, because it's always a moving point.
Yeah.
We're going to schematize and try to really, like, pin something down. If we define modernity as, like, the current epoch we're in, say, from, like, the technological age of 2000 to right now, it's going to change. But whether or not, or what it changes into, I don't know. Nobody really knows. Where it goes, I don't know. I mean, personally, I think we're living in a dark age. I mean, this is where McIntyre's work After Virtue, I take it from here, where we're living in a dark age of, you know, various aspects where we've lost. I think, I really do think we've lost. I think McIntyre's right. We've lost our sense of the virtues. We've lost our sense of, like, certain terms and ethics. We've lost kind of our reading of classical text. We'll see where it goes. But I mean, I'm of the opinion that, you know, we're living in this dark age and we have to find institutions and communities that allow us to kind of weather the storm.
I'll say a few. I mean, I think one part of that is it does seem like we've lost the energy or the vitality even to have that sort of a robust society, or just continually progressing. But I think we also have destroyed all of our institutions, and some of them have been destroyed maybe for good reasons, but it's kind of like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You certainly need some sort of institutions. So I guess, I don't know, what I try to synthesize, bring together, is like the freedom and just sort of wildness that kind of drives your vitality. And then what's the minimal amount of institutions we need to control that and propel it into the direction we want.
Mm-hmm.
So right now what I see is like splintering of like, one side wants to create more institutions. We want to create more rules, more laws. We want to more bureaucracy, just take it down that path. And I see another side that wants to destroy everything. And I think what you see in a renaissance or a vital society is somewhat of a fusion of the two things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would. There's a lot of ways you could talk about that. One way you could go is simply by saying, and this is my approach, is to start with kind of first principles. Say, okay, well, you know, here's our metaphysical commitments. This informs my view of the human person, which informs my ethics, and I'm going to model, you know, the way I live my life off of that. So that's a whole other topic. Another way you could go is kind of going like the Alexis de Tocqueville route, where there's a lot of emphasis placed on local community. I forgot his term for it, which I think is kind of what you seem to lean toward, civil society. No, I mean, I think these are all great things to reflect on, and, you know, it would be just extremely long and detailed conversations to work out specifics, but ultimately getting into specifics is what you're going to have to do. Mm-hmm. And just getting down to the nitty gritty. And I think that's really the theme of like what I've talked about today. And what I've emphasized the most is that there are no cut and dry bullet point answers. If you want to know, and if you want to really think deeply about these questions, you have to get into specifics and you have to do the work to do that. So yeah, that's what I would have to say off the top of my head.
Yeah, I think we can wrap it up here, I guess. I think we did like a broad overview. I'd like to potentially pick a topic in the future and kind of dive deeper on it. But
I mean, just to sum up, we talked about, I mean, my background in econ. We talked about some problems I saw with econ, which I think I actually learned working out right here. Learned some stuff from that, which is good. Talked a little bit about the relationship between Christianity, Plato. Talked about the classics, my reflections on the classics, my reflections on academia. I'm sure my opinions. Right, I tried to keep everything I said to exactly what I believe and what I think that I'll hold to for the rest of my life. But you know, eventually there'll probably be some changes. But I mean,
that's
I think
a difficulty, right? With recording things.
Exactly.
I can't think about it while I podcast, or it'll like destroy the whole thing.
Exactly. But I think that everything I said here, at least everything I said are conclusions that I've come to and that I've argued for and that I would stick by and argue with, and I think that are correct. But we'll leave it at that. We'll leave it at that.
I mean, at the very least, I think these are good topics to introduce to as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think this is gaining momentum. It feels like. I feel like more people are interested in classics. More people are interested in understanding religion, maybe the roots of it at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I think people can feel that something is missing.
Look at what Jordan Peterson has been doing with his lectures. I mean, he's been drawing hundreds of thousands of people with his weird psychological reading of the Bible. And I think that that's actually, I think that that is demonstrating that we in fact have this. You know, drive to kind of understand. I think he's helping to spark a revival in readings of some classic texts. So I think that that's actually spot on. I mean, keep an eye out for it. I mean, I've certainly experienced that in a lot of my encounters. Keep an eye out for it. Everybody listening, keep an eye out for, you know, people yearning for classic texts and classic wisdom, and try your best to initiate them into that tradition.
Yeah, I think I'm going to stop it here.
Perfect.